It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. So I also listened to my last week interview with Colleen Rowley, which got some very good reviews, but also had some technical problems, both on the audio and on the recording. There was heavy static at my end. That static has been straightened out. I did one of my 15-minute opinion shows on Friday, and listening to it, there was absolutely no static. So I hope that we continue that way. Speaking of the John Mack Radio rants, that may also be accessed by going to my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com, and clicking on the John Mack Radio Rants tab. Unlike this show, that show has no regular schedule, but is produced generally weekly, and as I mentioned, the most recent was the day before yesterday. My guest next week on this show is an architect and my 8th grade boarding school roommate, Michael Cohallen. I hope you'll join us then. My guest tonight is technologist Dwayne Henricks. I first knew Dwayne through his internet technology mailing list, which with Dave Farber's list, the most important list, in my estimation anyhow, on the internet addressing technology, social, legal, and policy issues. Over the years, I've had one-to-one conversations with Dwayne and have developed a deep respect for his knowledge and technology accomplishments, as well as his skills as a list moderator. We'll explore his many contributions in depth tonight, hopefully, on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Dwayne, and welcome to the show.
Good evening, John. Glad to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Detroit, Michigan. I went to an elementary school McGowan Elementary School. And I think where things got interesting was in 63, Detroit really got into this thing where President Eisenhower, you know, in the late 50s says, we got to turn out science and engineers. And Detroit really got into that, and they created a program. They took one high school and sort of what you call it a magnet school now, and they basically did intelligence testing on all the kids in the city, and the top 2% they took and put into this special program at this one high school, which was Cass Technical High School. It was a huge high school, like 10 stories, one city block, 5,000 students, and it had an astrophysics department, biochem. Basically, you could get a college education there almost, okay? So I was I put in what was called the science and arts program, and that's really got me started on science and tech, that particular experience at that high school. But before I got my amateur radio license at 12, when I was in elementary school. So that really got me started, the amateur radio thing.
What was the attraction there? I've been into radio for years, too. What was your attraction that sucked you in there, Tony?
I had a friend whose father was a ham, and he took me down to his father's ham shack in the basement of their home. And his dad wasn't around, but I just looked at it. And then he brought me back when his dad was there. And what excited me was that you could talk to anyone anywhere in the world. Okay? You could reach out. And that really got to me at the time. And I had been a shortwave listener before that. Okay? And so I listened to Radio Moscow. I did the thing where you'd send, QSL cards. And, you'd send a card to Radio Moscow and they'd send you something back, I had collected this potpourri of messages or return replies from all these different radio stations around the world. And then I got my amateur radio license and then I could reach out. So I would say that I became used to it at an early age to the idea that I could communicate. I had the ability to communicate anywhere in the world that I wanted to.
I was into that too, in that I had in early high school, a Grunding multiband, and I both used that. It had the very wide dial, and I was able to get stations all over the United States on it. And I was also able, shortwave, to listen to many of the stations you talked about. I did not send the cards, which I should have on reflection. Were you also into computer technology at an early age?
No, I was not. Not until college. We did have an IBM 1620 at Cass Tech, but I sort of played. I had a friend who was into it, and I was like, well, I'm into electronics. This computer stuff is nowhere.
After high school, you mentioned college. What happened after high school?
Well, I had a strange career in that. This is sort of hard to believe, but remember, there was this emphasis on getting top-notch science and engineers, and I was in this sort of really unique high school, which it was a meritocracy. I mean, multiracial. It was basically, if you had horns and a tail, you could function there and do well. Okay, I mean, that's the way it was then. It was remarkable. So when I was in the 10th grade in high school, I was actually also on the staff of the psychology department at Wayne State University. Okay, I had an office down at the university and I had a staff ID card. Okay. So I won't get into all how all that happened, but it did. So for me, I was already at high school and also at the university. I was in that two worlds. So I go to high school and then I go to my office at the university. And what I was working on was I was in comparative psych. So I was building experimental apparatus for psychologists who were testing animals. Okay. So that's how I was able to apply the training I got in electronics. So when I graduated from high school, it was sort of anticlimactic because I just went down to my office at the university. Okay, so I got into computers in my job at the psych department because the university was getting into time sharing. They had an IBM Model 67, and they were running the Michigan Terminal System, and they gave the office I was working at the university, this psych lab, a terminal. Okay, so we had time-sharing access to the university mainframe 24/7, and that was my first computer experience. And I learned programming. I only took one computer class in my career, which was an IBM 360 assembler class. And from that point on, I've never had a computer science class. I learned it all on my own.
For those of our audience that are too young to remember, the emphasis that Duane mentioned that President Eisenhower put on to science education was a result of national panic. The United States won World War II because of our preeminence in science and in manufacturing. We developed the first working electronic computer, even though it was too late to be used in a war, and of course the atomic bombs. Who are the world's leader in science, technology, manufacturing? And the Soviet Union would make claims that they had invented television and that they had done and they have these wonderful weapons and these clunky tanks. And then all of a sudden they launched Sputnik, and it was a culture shock in the United States. We had no idea of whether that had bombs in it or cameras or what was going on. And first President Eisenhower and to launch this push into science and technology, and we trained many people. We didn't reach the results of it till the Kennedy and then the Johnson administration, but that was the emphasis. And obviously, you profited from it, Dwayne.
I certainly did. Yeah, it was. Education was a different experience in that time. You know, it really was, because in the college they had a college within the college at Wayne State called Monteith College, and it was one of these free universities. There was no letter grades; it was pass fail. But they had a really special faculty, and they taught a lot of different topics in a much different way than you'd be used to. I mean, it's really hard to describe now, but it was like they took the top of your head off and they just started pouring stuff in. And so I really was blessed to have the Castech and then Monteith College, the college within the college at Wayne State, plus my job in the psych department, okay? Because that paid for the college was basically free at that time. And so given what I was being paid as a member of the staff, I had a lot of discretionary income, which I could put into my electronics and other stuff.
What major did you wind up with then if you were in psychology and in this unique college?
Cognitive psych.
Okay. Did you also write for school papers along the way? What got you into writing?
I didn't write then. I basically just did stuff, okay? I had a company on the side when I was in high school. I think what shifted me to the next stage of my career was in 1968 when the first Holder's Catalog came out. And that was a remarkable document, and that's how I found about Buckminster Fuller. He was showcased in the fall 68 first Holder's Catalog. And at the time, I didn't know Bucky Fuller from the doormat. I had no idea this person existed. But I got captivated by it, and so that led me, at the time I finished up at Monteith College, Fuller was at Southern Illinois University Carbondale, and he was a university professor. He had got there at 55, and he had a department there called the Design Department. And they were going to do the second World Games seminar in the summer of 1970. So I went down to SIU Carbondale that summer and spent the whole summer there working on Fuller's World Game.
Oh, wow. Just before we leave amateur radio, and I'm sure we'll come back to it, I know that you currently hold official positions in several not-for-profit amateur radio organizations, and you're also the co-founder and past director of the Wireless Communications Alliance. And that's the way I read on your resume. It's an industry group that represents manufacturers in the unlicensed radio industry. Please describe unlicensed radio and tell us more about your ongoing involvement with amateur radio.
Okay. In terms of my ongoing relationship with amateur radio, I've done it all in radio. I mean, I build Heath kits. I build my own stuff. I did HF radio, VHF, UHF, and then I started building experimental radios, okay, and data radios. So I stopped doing the conventional ham stuff. There's a nonprofit in there are actually three nonprofits organizations, 501c3s in amateur radio. There's AMSAT, who should be obvious what they do, amateur satellites, the American Radio Relay League, the ARRL, and then something called TAPR, Tucson Amateur Packet Radio. They do digital radio. So I hold a position I've had since, I think, the mid-90s. I'm an assistant director of the Pacific Division of the American Radio Relay League. And so I've worked under three directors in that division. So what I try to do in – I do technical stuff, but I also try to do this inside and outside approach where I think it's important to play politics or to work in politics and not just be a techie. You know, you got to be balanced. You got to be well-rounded. So I've spent a lot of time in my career doing just that. And as I said, I've been held this position as an assistant director, which is sort of an advisory position to the director and I've held that job for a long time and had some impact, I hope. I know. So now let's talk about unlicensed radio. I'm a serial entrepreneur, so I came to Silicon Valley in 76 to work for a company called Amdahl Corporation, and I did that. So basically about 1980, I started working for myself, and I formed a company, and I did consulting, and then I started essentially in 1990, I co-founded a company with a guy named Charlie Brown called Tevilus Access Limited. And our mission was to develop an unlicensed spread spectrum radio, data radio, that could cover a metropolitan area. Okay? It was mesh networking, peer-to-peer, all that stuff. Okay? Now, this was 1990, and we formed this company. At the same time, Paul Barron was one of the co-founders of Metricom, which was using unlicensed spectrum, but so where Tetherless Access was doing wireless internet, Paul's company was doing their clients or their anchor tenants were power companies, utility companies. So they wanted to do meter reading and stuff using unlicensed spectrum. So they were going low data, so they use what's called frequency hopping spread spectrum, while we use direct sequence spread spectrum, which allowed higher data rates.
Now the Amdahl you had started with, was that Gene Amdahl's company, the ex-IBM designer?
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Well, but at that time, weren't they focused on mainframe alternatives to the IBM technology?
Right. Well, what I rapidly found out, I mean, I remember you're talking about Farber didn't go into cosmology because his father told him not to, but I had an advisor because I was following this psychology path, and my advisor said, hey, don't become a psych professor like me because, you know, you won't like it. You won't make the kind of money you really could make. So I said, okay. So, I got a job in the university's computing center, okay, and I learned how to become an IBM 360 system programmer, okay, and I started getting paid lots of money. And so anyway, at the time that I got asked to go work for Amdahl, I was assistant director of the Southern Illinois University Computing Center, and we were running this VM370 operating system. And I had come up with some modifications to that operating system that allowed it to do some magical things, okay? So that attracted the attention of IBM Research. So what happened was I got job offers from IBM Research in Poughkeepsie and Gene Amdahl in Sunnyvale. So I took the Sunnyvale, and I went with Gene Amdahl. So at the time, I was hired by Amdahl to be a VM 370 programmer. And what we did with VM was use the virtual machine capability to debug the Amdahl mainframe processors.
You mentioned Amdahl, and I know that you also served as both general manager of the wireless business unit for COM21 and the aforementioned CEO and co-founder of Tedless Access. But in addition to this, you also got into some public service work. You were the co-principal investigator for the NSF's Wireless Field Test for Education. And you're also a past member of the FCC's Technology Advisory Council. I believe DeFab was also on that at one time. And you served for 8 years. How did you mix all of this together?
Well, it wasn't all at the same time, but sort of was. As I said earlier, I think it's important to do the public policy stuff. I mean, we're a nation of laws, and, you know, and laws get made, and you need to work on influencing that, especially, again, as an entrepreneur. I mean, being a good entrepreneur is just not focusing down on tech. You got to look at the business aspects of it. And with wireless, it's FCC, 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 okay? So you don't attend to that at your peril. So I got involved early on in Tedless Access, and that Apple was making a big push for Spectrum at the time for what became the Newton. And there was a guy there that named Jim Lovett, who was like my mentor on Spectrum policy, also a telecom attorney in D.C. by the name of Henry Goldberg, who was representing Apple at the time. So we were able to get a lot of spectrum, what's called the Unlicensed National Information Infrastructure Band of 300 megahertz at 5 gigahertz, allocated in a what was called a fast track, okay? So I think at the time where they were auctioning off spectrum, we were able to get 300 megahertz, which was more than any cellular company had, for free, okay? So that's a remarkable story in and of itself, but after that was done, I sort of stopped being an entrepreneur in terms of a company, and I did this NSF project, the Wireless Field Test Project. And in 96, I led an expedition to Mongolia, okay? And we helped Mongolia get on the Internet for the first time. NSF paid for a satellite ground station, 256 kilobits. And I went there to do a wireless metropolitan area network for the entire town of Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital of Mongolia. Okay? So
What was the weather like in Mongolia?
It was the winter.
And does that mean very, very cold?
Well, have you ever heard of this thing called the Gobi Desert?
Oh, okay. Sure.
The Gobi Desert makes the Sahara Desert look like a resort. Okay?
You've mentioned a number of times, and we do have in most cases, a technology savvy audience, but there are others to want. Would you explain Spectrum and the problems with allocation?
Sure. Spectrum policy and how it's developed is a really interesting historical tale, and I think it's important for people who are not technologists or into tech to understand it, because it's an important public policy area. The radio spectrum was pretty much open, say, at the time of Marconi at the start of the 20th century. And after the Titanic disaster, things changed, okay? Governments all around the world stepped in and decided they needed to regulate the radio spectrum. And they essentially adopted a property regimen in that they treated spectrum as like property, and they created bands, and they broke it up into little chunks, and they assigned services to those chunks. And given the technology at the time, the radio devices, that's sort of what you had to do to prevent what was called interference. Okay? Well, that sort of worked for a long time until post-World War II, when Claude Shannon came out with his law, and we developed digital electronics, and we could now do things, and the military came up with the spread spectrum technology. Now, I mean, all the stuff that started in World War II, the famous Hedda Lamarr story, she was a developer of frequency hopping spread spectrum. But then direct sequence spread spectrum came through a different path. But to try to describe how those technologies work is sort of magical in that, think of it this way. With spread spectrum, you can essentially overlay a conventional radio transmission, okay? And that's what they did during the war and post-war, okay, where, you use spread spectrum to do covert communications. So they can't hear you, they can't find you, all right? And it's very sophisticated. And so what the FCC wanted to do in the late 70s was change the rules from this property regimen to what we'd call like an open spectrum or open field where you could use the spread spectrum technology and no longer have to adhere to band plans. You could basically transmit anywhere you wanted to. Okay. Now, this was a radical departure from the existing way things were, and as the process went forward, there was a lot of pushback from the usual suspects. But the thing was, the military had been using these technologies, and in the mid-70s were sort of declassified. So what the FCC wanted to do was to take all this declassified technology and put it into the commercial sector. So to make a long story short, what came out of that in 1985 were the unlicensed radio rules, where this is important in that prior to those unlicensed radio rules coming out in 85, the general public, I mean, you had to have a license to operate a transmitter in United States territory. And those were rare as hen's teeth, okay? With the unlicensed rules, anybody could now start operating a transmitter legally. This is a sea change, and look at what it has wrought, like Wi-Fi, among other things, okay? So Well, early Wi-Fi used spread spectrum technology. It used direct sequence technology. And that was at tetherless access, we were using direct sequence spread spectrum radios. Okay? At the time, I think they went 180 kilobits. This was like in 1995. Okay?
For the non-technical audience, what we're talking about is, for years, historically, as Duane said, different types of communication, AM radio, FM radio, televisions, they were told they could operate at certain frequencies, and the frequencies then were contained in a band. And we got in as we got into more of the different types of transmission, be it ultra-high frequency television, then be it the internet, obviously, and cellular towers, there's been tremendous fight to understand how we can manage all the space, and Duane's been active in that. Did I misspeak in any way, Duane?
No, not at all.
Okay.
So I've sort of been leading the charge for what's called the open spectrum movement, in that I want to deploy these technologies that the military or the surveillance crowd uses and has used for years in the commercial sector. Okay, and there's an element in that surveillance community, or that, think about it. I mean, what the FCC was proposing to do in 85 was to take this technology the military using, albeit that had been declassified, but put that in the hands of everybody so that, think about it, everybody starting could have covert, unjammable, undetectable communications, okay? So think about, I mean, and that was the public policy issue at the time. So the original FCC proposal that came out in 81 in a notice of inquiry was to turn the entire spectrum into an open commons and with no power limits, okay? That was the original proposal in 81. In 84, when they came out with the notice of rulemaking in NPRM, certain parts of the spectrum were excluded for, like, radio astronomy. And there had been a power limit set of about 700 watts. 700 watts is a lot of power, okay? So that was the proposal going into 84. In 85, when the forces of darkness got their way, that most of the spectrum 700-watt power thing got cut down to three little bands and a one-watt power limit, okay? That's what happened. That's the flow. Because the thought of regular American citizens having this technology at their beck and call was terrifying to certain parties in the government, all right? So they thought by putting these egregious rules in place that it would stamp it out and that it couldn't go anywhere. And so what the rules were for regular people was quite different for the amateur radio community in that we were doing spread spectrum experimentation at the time, and we were building our own spread spectrum radios. Well, they basically limited us to three spreading codes, which effectively killed – I mean, think about it. It's like you have an infinite number of code spaces you could use, and we're cut down to three that weren't very interesting, which wouldn't allow us to cloak our communications at all. So they effectively killed spread spectrum in the amateur radio service. All right? By design.
I remember during my CB days, the limitations when you had to be licensed were 4 watts, but everyone hung linear amplifiers in their cars and between the – or they used the Yaesu down in the CB bands, and they were broadcasting at 40, at 70, at 100 watts. And then finally the FCC gave up.
Well, yeah, they let the citizen band run open loop. They didn't do that with amateur radio, okay? And we never had those kind of problems because we were gentlemen. We were civilized, okay? But an important area of research, because what amateur radio is supposed to be about is advancing the radio state of the art. And we weren't able to play with those technologies. And I think everybody suffered as a result because the normal path had been amateurs do stuff and pioneer an area, and then it gets turned into commercial products. That was all vacated, all right, that path, okay?
Was your time with the FCC then frustrating? Were you the voice crying in the wilderness, or were there others who thought like you?
Well, there was others that thought like me, but here's what happened. The Technological Advisory Council was started in 98 during the tail end of the Clinton administration. Reed Hundt had been the previous FCC chairman, and Clinton brought in this guy named Bill Kennard. And Bill basically brought in a guy named Dale Hadfield, eminent technologist and academic, to head the Office of Engineering and Technology. And Dale just, you know, with the backing of the chairman, did a lot of neat stuff. He created the TAC. He started the ultra-wideband rulemaking. He started a lot of important rulemaking. So under a Democratic administration, the innovation spigot got turned on. Okay, so for those first 2 years of the TAC, we did amazing things that I'm proud of. But then the Bush administration came in, and then Michael Powell became FCC chair, and that's when things went to hell, okay, as far as I'm concerned. So, yes, we still had a TAC, but Powell didn't give a hoot in hell about the TAC, all right? And so we just became we meet four times a year and just talk about stuff that nobody at the commission really cared about. All right. And then after Paul, there was Martin, Kevin Martin became chairman, and he was really anti-tech or anti-innovation, and he did what he was told. The thing about Paul is that he would sort of run free open loop, and the Bush administration didn't like that. And so when he left, it was like, you know, the door hits you in the whatever. And Martin was – he was a company man, and he closed down the TAC. And he also closed down the rulemakings that we had spent 8 years working on. So he basically shut down the what was called the interference temperature rulemaking, which was to allow this approach of, you know, allowing you to transmit anywhere in the radio spectrum under the noise floor, and then what was called the receiver standards rulemaking. Here's the thing. You see, to do spread spectrum right, you have to know the characteristics of the receiver and the transmitter. The FCC characteristically only regulates transmitters. The military doesn't do that. They have to look at both because they have a metric called LPI, low probability of intercept. And so you have to look at it as a communication system so you can know the characteristics of both. All right? So they've had a classified database of all the characteristics of all the receivers that are manufactured for years. Okay, but the FCC doesn't look at receivers. So what we were pushing them to do was to look at receivers because interference is determined by the characteristics of the receiver, not the transmitter. Okay? So if those rulemakings that Martin shut down had gone through, we would have an entirely different regulatory environment than we do today.
Now, you mentioned that the Republican administrations shut this down. What's happened under President Obama? Has there been a change? Is it more open to innovation, the FCC, now?
Nope. Basically, you could say, as in other areas, Obama has continued Bush administration policies.
Okay. And we can certainly get to that. How did you happen to start the internet mailing list, and what do you feel the focus and the membership is of the list?
Well, I found out about Farber's list and I got on it, and I sort of decided I wanted to do something like that, but focus on wireless. And so early on, so I've been doing it for over 10 years now. And so I started with wireless, and then I sort of expanded to other areas. And so I would say that Dave runs his list sort of differently than mine in that I go out and seek out articles, so I curate things, okay, that I post to my list. So I never post anything to my list that I don't read, you know, totally, because that's – what my responsibility is running the list is to be a good curator. And so I get a lot of submissions from my readers. And like Dave, I don't really let the discussion threads go. I mean, it's not a discussion list. It's a moderated list, and I choose the topics. And I may, like he does, take two things, replies on a particular article, and then that's it, and move on. Dave has a list, and only he knows the size of it, but he also has an RSS feed for his list, and you never know how many people are reading that. So like him, I don't have as many people. I have like, you know, 1,500 people on the list, but, I think like him, it's like you send me an email and that's how you get on the list. But I'm sort of picky about who I let on, so I sort of curate the list a bit. And then I have an RSS feed. And I know most of the people that get the list now get it from the RSS feed or just go to the blog version of it.
How much work does it entail? I know that you both identified the source of the posting and you snip the articles. How much time does that take?
For me, it takes a bit of time. I get up, I only sleep 4 hours a night, So I usually am down from 11 till 3. I get up around 3, and I start going over the net. I have a lot of information sources that I scan, and I basically make a selection, and then I go and read the article. That takes time, but when I was in high school, they taught us speed reading, okay? So that particular skill has stood me in good stead, all right? And then I start posting things until about, 6 or 7 in the morning, and then things come in, and then I whenever I have some spare time during the day, I'll pick it up again.
Yeah, I've moved most of my postings and my magazine article feeds to Twitter and to Facebook, but it's a similar thing. I wake up for some reason at 3, 4 in the morning, and at that time, the early editions of the Times and the Washington Post are up there, and I'll put them out as tweets, and then that flows through to Facebook. My list has really turned into a political discussion group, and I spend less time on it than I originally did when I set it up. There has been, of course, most posted on your list about Edward Snowden, both his activities and the revelations. When I had ex-FBI agent Colleen Riley on last week, we discussed the matter. I've discussed it. I've been really a show with Mark Rausch, and I've been writing about it. What are your thoughts on the subject? Can we separate the legality of his action from the revelations?
There's a tradition in this country for whistleblowers, and the law doesn't necessarily match up with reality, okay? I mean, the Espionage Act, since the early part of the 20th century, is a real problem. So I come down with I think Snowden is a true American hero, not a traitor. I think he needed to do something that had to be done. He did something that had to be done, and I think he did it in a measured, well-thought-out way. And anybody that didn't think that can look at his recent NBC interview, okay, where he got a chance to speak his mind. But now to talk about the ramifications of it. It's like it's not that it confirmed a lot of what I thought, but it went way and beyond that, okay? So let me describe it this way, and this is important. I want to get this out. There's a television show on CBS called Person of Interest, and I highly recommend people watch this show. It just finished its third season, and here's how I found about the show. I have a friend who's a retired naval intelligence guy, and he doesn't watch a lot of television, okay? And he's into crypto and spycraft and stuff, and he's really worked for years to keep his presence, to preserve his anonymity, okay? So he has very few close friends. He came to me, and said, look, you really need to watch Person of Interest. And I said, well, okay. So I bounced between Detroit and Fremont. I have a place to stay with some friends in Fremont when I go there on business. And I get there, and soon after this experience, my friend, the Navy spook guy, and they said, have you seen Person of Interest? You got to watch it. And I said, wow, okay. So I went and got the first season and blitzed it. And the show's done by J.J. Abrams, who did Lost and a bunch of other shows of that fringe. And he's doing what Gene Roddenberry did with Star Trek. He's using a TV show and to do a sort of a modern morality, ethics, whatever, okay? And for some strange reason, it's a top 10 rated show. So a lot of people are watching this. And the episodes cost about $2 million to produce. And so with 22 episodes in a season, that's a lot of money. But when you look at the show, it's about something called the machine that was developed by this genius billionaire who has given it to the government to identify terrorist threats. And the machine is connected to all of our surveillance cameras, microphones, everything all around the world. Okay? So, and the way the show starts out is the voice of this guy, whose name is Finch, and he says, "You are being watched." That's how the show starts. That's the lead-in. So, after I watched the first season, I went back to my naval intelligence friend and said, "Look, I understand now why you wanted me to watch this show, because it's about what's happening now. I mean, they started the show before the Snowden revelations, but now in this third season, they've brought in the Snowden revelations, plus all the stuff that nobody's really thought about yet, like about the private companies, like, okay, Booz Allen. It's like all the attention's been on the NSA, but nobody's looking at things like Booz Allen and what is the true nature of our surveillance state? Who are the players?
Axion.
Okay?
Axion.
Yeah. So they are covering this in the show. And the way this season ended was just amazing in terms of it's like it took the Snowden revelations and what remains to be revealed and sort of put it in the context. It's like you're watching Star Trek, you know, and it's like, well, it's not science fiction. It's here now, okay? I mean,
I watch it regularly. And okay. The other thing that struck me, and there's an almost soap opera, melodramatic political show scandal, but one of the things of it is that there is an agency that no one knows about that's doing all sorts of illegal things, and it's always to protect the country. And presidents have tried to dismantle it, and then something happens, and they bring it back, and they're actually killing people, and they're doing surveillance. It's not covered either as in depth or as well as person of interest. But if you put these two shows together, they're rather scary. The two things that really concern me about this is number one that. If we read all of the literature, that after the church committee that was headed by Democrat Frank Church, and also the co-chair was Republican Howard Baker, there were rules laid out for our intelligence service, and apparently they were followed until 9/11. Now, according to all the stories that come out after 9/11, George Bush said all wraps are off, and they did a bunch of illegal things that we found out about recently. During his election, leading up to the election, during his campaign, our constitutional lawyer, President Barack Obama, said that we're going to have complete transparency, and any things that have been going on that are questionable, they'll be reviewed, and if there is something unconstitutional about them, they'll be eliminated. And once he got into office, nothing changed at all. Then all of a sudden, the Snowden revelations came out, and all of a sudden, he's going to fix it. Now, you know, I'm troubled by the fact I can almost understand better the reaction after 9/11, where there was all sorts of concern. But I'm troubled that it went on for so long, and that a new administration of a different party that was publicly on record as dismantling things like this, they let it continue. The other thing I'm concerned about, and Mark Rausch brought this out when he was on this program, and he agreed with many of the surveillance things, but he said the problem is that the public should have the right to debate these things, and perhaps you can build a case for surveillance if you can point out that it saved us from 23,000 terrorist incidents. If it's only saved us from two, then we probably won't do it. Well, he said that whenever the challenge, the only answer is that they're protecting us, and when we say, well, tell us how and how many incidents, that's classified. So we can never get to understand what's going on, really. Any comments?
Well, of course not. It's like as it plays out in persons of interest, governments have to build something like the machine. Our government is on a trajectory to build the machine as depicted in that show. And in fact, they basically pretty much have it, you know, with the facial recognition, all the cameras out there, you know, it's like there's more. But I think from according to my naval intelligence friend, this stuff was going on before 9/11. So make no mistake about that. It's just, you know, it got scaled up, but it was going on. But here's the thing, John. It's like we're rapidly converging towards the world of Minority Report and pre-crime, okay? Because it's like this capability is being misused all the time now. And we find out about it, and there's nothing we can do about it, nothing. So we see our government breaking laws, and whenever we try to look at what EFF, the two-step they go through, you know? Is they get close to bite the apple, and then it gets yanked out of their grasp, okay? Because national security concerns or whatever, all right? So I don't see how we get out of this mess, because at the end of the show this season, basically the machine was starting to go and target people like the intellectuals, you know, the people that, well, we need to get rid of these people because they can cause trouble, like Occupy Wall Street. So we know that they were surveilled upon, you know. You see what I'm saying? So it's here now, and we talk about it, but to do something about it, it's like, look, on my list, I got one of my readers sent me a State Department sit rep, but, you know, this was around the time of the Russian Olympics. And it basically said, look, if you go to Russia and take your laptop with you, it could be confiscated and all this crazy stuff could happen. Okay? So he sent it to me, and I was going to post it to the list. And then he sent me an email that says, look, don't – if you post it, don't put my name on it. You know? And he says – I go back to him and say, why? He says, well, I do a lot of traveling, and I don't want to take the chance that this could put me on the no-fly list. And then I came back and says, well, come on. I mean, think about – what you're doing, you're self-censoring yourself, you know, and okay, but you see what I mean? That's what we're doing now. We're self-censoring ourselves, and not speaking of it, because we don't want to end up in the no-fly list, or we want to be able to qualify for TSA pre-check or whatever. You see what I'm saying? So when does it end? It won't.
Well, we also have a very short attention span. I mean, if it weren't for Snowden's interview on NBC in the middle of the week, he hadn't been in the news, and people hadn't talked about it. This was a hot issue 2 months ago, and then we forget about it. Then we have a hot issue about something else, and we forget about it. I think that we're so caught up in our lives and in the economy and in jobs that people just don't have the interest, and I think that's very unfortunate.
I don't disagree, but I don't know how to do anything about it.
Another focus of yours has been the future of the Internet. And we just talked about two of the issues, privacy, security, government surveillance. There's also net neutrality with the fast lane. There's our rights about information, that people are using our information for marketing purposes. They're profiling us. And the list goes on and on. I know that you've been working on the project with the Institute for the Future, called Second Curve Internet, a 10-year effort to reinvent the Internet. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, the Institute for the Future has been around for 47 years. Paul Barron, my mentor, was one of the co-founders. So it's been around for a long time, longer than a lot of companies. And it's been, this mission is to, you know, forecast the future. And they play the long game. The reason I was happy to go work with the Institute for the Future is that if you look at what happens in the Beltway, it's all people playing the short game, okay?
You know? 2 weeks.
And, yeah, 2 weeks, whatever. And they don't realize that we're fighting a multi-front war, you know, and they always do single front, and they, you know, doing it, let's get rid of SOPA, okay? Let's organize, boom, 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 and then, okay, we won. Then they go back to the weeds, all right? That is the way wars work, you know. And so we need like people, generals like a patent or something in these, you know, to really understand this and say, look, we got to, you got to keep working on this stuff and you got to learn how to fight a multi-front war over time. Well, that's what the Institute does. Okay. So every year they come out with a 10-year forecast. And so this year they did something different. They said, look, we've been forecasting the future for all these years, but it's time to start trying to influence the future because our forecast for this year is the darkest one we've ever done, ever, in 47 years. You know, we're screwed, all right? So they said, look, we're going to take 10 projects, and we're going to work on these things over a 10-year period and try to influence them, craft it into something that may be a brighter future. So one of those projects is the second curve internet. So what we're trying to do is look at how we can reinvent the internet, all right? And key to that is going back to the original founding Braybeard's concept of the internet, because the internet's a loaded word now. What does it mean? It means a lot of things to different people. I know what it means to me, which is, well, anyway, this a network that runs a TCP/IP protocol suite to talk to other networks. But we peer with each other. We agree to peer. And when you peer with somebody, you have to authenticate them and you have to trust them. Okay? That's fundamental, I think, to a reinventing of the internet, in that we have to get away from this grab bag we got now to something where, like, as, you know, Farber said in his interview with you, where the security and privacy concerns weren't addressed at the beginning, we got to do that now. Okay? And I think we know how to start to do that. But to come up with really technologies for good authentication, it's going to be tough, especially in these times. I mean, look at what happened with TrueCrypt, you know, and it's like, oh, man, one of our key cornerstones is gone now, all right? So it's going to be a tough road. But, again, the Institute wants to play the long game on this, which I think is the way to go.
You gave a terrific presentation on this subject at Stanford University recently. I'll be happy to send the URL for the PDF to anyone who emails me at johnmack13@gmail.com asking for it. During the presentation, you mentioned the darknet, which the name pops up every now and then. Would you go into that? Would you tell our audience what the darknet is?
The darknet is another loaded word like the internet. Usually it's given negative connotations. It's where people go to steal files and content, or where there's drug trafficking and stuff. But like the word hacker, there are good hackers and bad hackers. Okay?
Steve Wozniak was a good hacker.
Yeah, so I go to this conference every year called the Hackers Conference. Okay,
right.
Which is for good hackers. All right. So the darknet, I've been a member of the darknet since about 2000. And you can consider them gated communities where there are rules, and you have to be invited in. And if you don't play by the rules, you're expunged forever. And so technology has been developed that are the internet technologies we're thinking of for the second curve internet, where we don't worry about DNS, okay? I mean, we have auto-discovery technologies, okay, that have been deployed. So it's like it's a different internet. We use the regular internet just for transport, but we have a whole different set of technologies. BitTorrent is one of the key ones, but then you have recent things like Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a peer-to-peer technology that essentially runs over the darknet, okay? And it's a virtual currency. So there's a lot of other things you can do with these technologies other than share copyrighted content. And to me, that's very exciting, and that's where this future second curve internet is going to start, with the darknet. And Bitcoin is a good example of that kind of fundamental change.
You mentioned in the presentation that you moved back to Detroit. Now, you had grown up there, as you told us, you went to school there, and then you moved to Silicon Valley. What was the draw to bring you back?
Well, personal reasons are that my mom is here, and she's 92. So she's 92, and she's in good shape. She still drives. No major health problems, but she's 92, so I thought I should be close. The other part of it is I wanted to come back here and see if I could do anything because, you know, Detroit's in the news, and this is my hometown, and this is not the place I grew up in anymore. I mean, by a long shot. But I moved back 4 years ago, and I've come to the conclusion there isn't really much I can do here to affect any real change.
What about the science programs in the high school that you went to and the dual majors at the university? Are they still around, or they all go by the wayside?
That college, Monteith College, was closed down soon after I graduated. Okay, I mean, all that stuff in the mid 70s just sort of disappeared. I mean, we had a different country as we rolled into the 80s, you know. So all that stuff was gone. The science and arts program, gone, you know, gone with the wind.
If you don't feel they can do much there, what is in the future for Duane Henricks?
That's a good question. I'm going to stick with this second tier of internet thing with the Institute. Again, it's been to work with an organization that plays a long game is important, and it's already led to things outside the country. Like, for instance, I was recently invited to speak at a conference in Kiev on June 5th and 6th to talk about second curve internet and deploying the internet under, you know, egregious conditions. But I can't go because I have a previous commitment. But think about it. All expense paid to Kiev to talk about the internet. That's what I was offered.
We've covered a lot of bases in exploring your interesting and productive career. What else might you like our audience to know about Duane Henricks?
Well, okay, I'm black, okay, so I think it's important to point out in my career, again, here in Detroit, I mentioned earlier in the interview that in the early 60s, it was a meritocracy. I was able to do amazing things because it wasn't, like I said, if you had horns and a tail, if you could do stuff, you know, you could rise. And so in my career, I have not experienced this kind of discrimination that others have, okay? You know, I think I'm good at what I do, and I've had two world-class mentors I've been fortunate to have. Bucky Fuller was the first one, and then the second one was Paul Barron, who is, I think, who's passed away now, but he was one of the best serial entrepreneurs that Silicon Valley's ever had. If you look at his history and the companies he's did, it's just remarkable what he was able to accomplish. So what I learned from that experience is to share, to mentor, and it's a hard thing to do these days because mentoring has sort of fallen out of favor for some reason. I don't, you know. So go ahead.
That's very interesting. During the early days, I was very active on the early days of the MUDs and MUs on Lambda Mu and Diversity University. And one of the things that struck me very early was that the first thing that we notice about the person when we meet them is their race. Well, at Lambda Mu, there was no tall, short, black, white, Hispanic. There was people, and you got directly into their minds rather than the physical appearance. And if you met them later, you already knew them. You hadn't formed any preconceived thoughts about how they might be because they were heavy or they were black or they were white. I thought that was a terrific experience. And when I taught a class at Marist College, it was our first online thing back before there were MOOCs or anything. I was teaching the graduate course, And the capstone course in the information systems graduate program was something called policy, and it was a seminar course. And just at that time, IBM started transferring people all over the country to Burlington, Vermont, and to Austin, Texas, and to Raleigh. And we didn't want the students just showing up at the local college and saying, "Do you have a course like this?" So we set up this this course on Diversity University, and I met with them every Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. And one day, we're starting the course. We're starting to take the class, and people, they're saying what they did over the weekend, just how are you. And the fellow in Austin said, "Oh, it was very hot here yesterday. The weather changed. I was out in the yard working all day, and boy, am I brown." The guy in Raleigh said, "I'm always brown." And it had never come up that one was Caucasian and one was black. And I thought that was just mind-boggling. I thought that was terrific, you know. So hopefully, the technology will help us overcome what hundreds of years haven't.
That's sort of been my experience in that I've traveled the globe, like, you know, the Mongolia experience. I mean, you know, it's like I've learned how to go to Africa, Tonga. It's a big planet, and there's a lot of diversity. And I found that if you go in there without any prejudice, you know, and just talk to people as people, it can get you a long way, okay? So I think for me, that's what I'm going to continue to try to do. You asked me what I'm looking at for the future, but it's like to let people know that, you know, we can have a meritocracy. It's not a fantasy concept. We used to do it in this country, okay? And there's nothing to stop us from doing it again, you know? We are a nation of minds and laws, okay? You know, that just, it's not just the physical stuff in the race, because anyway. But I got to tell you, this country is really interracial, you know. I mean, really is. I mean, and it was that way when I was growing up. But you know what? Like, for instance, okay, my elementary school, in August, we're going to have, I went to a diverse Jewish, white, brown elementary school, okay? We're going to have our 50th reunion in August. So we kept in touch with each other, a sizable amount of that class. 50 years later, we're going to have a reunion. You know, I'm good friends with a lot of people I went to elementary school with, white and black, okay? So that, to me, is sort of remarkable.
I do that, too. And last week, I was at the fellows who will be my guest next week. He was my roommate in the eighth grade at a military school, and I was at his 50th wedding anniversary celebration last week. So yeah, and I've kept very close with the neighborhood that I grew up in, and the people that I went to various schools with. It's all what got me to where I am. So as you mentioned, it's part of your history, is who the mentors were, who the friends were, and we shouldn't let go of that.
Exactly.
There anything else you'd like to add, Duane?
Well, on this thing, just one little thing. It's like when I was in elementary school, I was in the Boy Scouts, and the Boy Scout troop was a Jewish Boy Scout troop was associated with a temple, okay? So I was the only black person in this Jewish Boy Scout troop, okay? Temple Bethel here in Detroit. And think about that, okay? You know, it was like I would go to the services and whatever, and I'm not Jewish, but I was just part of the troop, you know? And I actually got voted to be senior patrol leader of Jewish Boy Scout troop, right, in the 60s. So there you go. I mean, you know, who would have thought? So there are things in my experience when I try to tell people that, like, being on the staff of the psych department at Wayne State University when I was in high school, that, you know, stretches credibility, but it's true. And it's, I think it's important for people to know that you know, the standard stories about how things have to be aren't necessarily the way they were or have to be, okay? So that's my parting shot.
Thank you very much for your time. And it's been a real pleasure. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer, Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Tune in next week for my conversation with architect Michael Cohallen. And settle in, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Steady, Silver, steady.